From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. On today's Labor Day special, as instability continues to grip Iraq, we speak to award-winning author of The Orange Trees of Baghdad, Leila Nadir, about her fear for the country she loves.
The country is now already over. To me, Iraq is actually finished at this point. You have Baghdad being separated from Kurdistan and the central area. The Iraqi army obviously has no power. The government obviously has no power. You have this jihadist group of a few thousand people that have managed to get in and create something. What they'll create, how long it will last. Once something is broken like that, how are they going to put it back together?
That's our special edition of FSN Reports with award-winning Iraqi-Canadian author Leila Nadir. That's after our summary of the day's news headlines.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. Russia's foreign ministers called for an immediate ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. This comes as representatives from Moscow, Kiev and the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic are meeting in Belarus to discuss the ongoing crisis. Kiev has accused Moscow of a direct invasion, with Ukrainian forces fleeing rebel advances in the southeast of the country. Jake Rashbass reports from Moscow.
Andrei Pagin, the deputy prime minister of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, is attending the talks in Minsk, but said that they would only be a first step in negotiations. Over the weekend, the EU presented Moscow with an ultimatum of new sanctions against Russia if it continues intervening in Ukraine. Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov has said that any new sanctions from the West would force Russia to protect its economy, businesses, and citizens. Ukraine's Western allies have accused Russian troops of coming to help the rebels in eastern Ukraine, who were otherwise almost defeated. Russia has denied that any of its troops are fighting in eastern Ukraine and has called for an immediate ceasefire from both sides. Jake Rashbass, Moscow.
Pakistan's national television channel has come off the air after its headquarters were stormed by anti-government protesters in Islamabad. PTV was showing live images of crowds breaking open the gates and pouring into its offices when its transmission stopped. Latest reports say troops have removed protesters from the building. Demonstrators want the Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, to step down. He denies accusations of corruption and electoral fraud. Pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong have disrupted a speech by a Beijing official explaining voting changes in the territory. They've chanted and held placards accusing Beijing of breaking its promises to allow Hong Kong to directly choose its own leader. The Chinese government on Sunday ruled out the open nomination of candidates for the chief executive election in 2017. British Prime Minister David Cameron is set to announce new anti-terror legislation later in response to the threat posed by Islamic State militants fighting in Syria and Iraq. However, it's understood the Prime Minister's Conservative Party and coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats, were still not in final agreement on Monday about new plans to tackle extremism. It's thought over 500 Britons have travelled to Syria and Iraq to fight, and there are growing fears some could attempt to attack the UK on their return. But there are civil rights concerns about some of the Prime Minister's plans, notably over his desire to seize passports from UK citizens who've travelled to foreign conflicts. Reporter Tom Swarbrick says some of the measures do already have agreement from both parties.
Things like an agreement with airlines to make sure the security services have easier access to their records and passenger manifests. You've got the idea of easing cooperation with countries like Germany and Turkey to stop people coming and going to Iraq or Syria.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Poland has been marking the 75th anniversary of the start of World War II with a wreath-laying ceremony at Gdańsk port. Prime Minister Donald Tusk commemorated the dead of the war's first battle. Nazi Germany invaded Poland on the 1st of September 1939, shelling a Polish garrison at Gdańsk. Britain and France declared war on Germany 2 days later. Police in New Zealand have detained a man suspected of shooting two people dead and injuring a third at an unemployment office. The incident happened in the town of Ashburton, southwest of Christchurch. A man entered a Work and Income New Zealand office and opened fire before escaping. Two people were killed, and a third was in a serious but stable condition, according to local police. Cuba is bringing in new rules limiting personal imports of foreign goods into the country, where locally made items are scarce and expensive. Around $2 billion in goods have been flown into Cuba in travellers' baggage each year since air travel restrictions were lifted in 2009. Many ordinary Cubans say the new rules will end one of their sources of high-quality consumer goods. The government says the new measures are aimed at professional mules. Google is working on a fleet of drones to deliver disaster relief to isolated areas. The work, done by the company's clandestine research team, Google X, has been kept secret for 2 years. Rachel Silverman reports now from San Francisco.
Google is calling it Project Wing, a fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles designed to bypass earthbound traffic so disaster relief packages can be delivered more quickly. In test flights, the drones have already delivered first aid kits, candy bars, dog treats, and water to farmers after traveling about a kilometer. Google says it will be several more years before Project Wing becomes fully operational.
That's the latest feature story news. Ollie Barrett reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to this special edition of FSN Reports. Today, we talk to award-winning novelist Leila Nadir about her memoir, The Orange Trees of Baghdad. Described as both a love story and lament for a place never visited, through her father's stories, she tells the tale of their family, the country he came from, and what happened after he left. The book comes at a time when Iraq is once again in the grip of violence and uncertainty as the Islamic State continues to spread its campaign of fear. But I began by asking Leila about her origins and the influence they had on her work.
So I'm half Iraqi and half Canadian, or my mum's actually British. So I grew up in England and Canada in a double-cultured house. And my father was not particularly one of these immigrants that forced his culture on us or sort of was talking about the homeland, often. But I was always very conscious that I was Iraqi, that he spoke Arabic, that I had relatives that used to come when I lived in England. They would drive from Baghdad across the country, across Europe, and visit us. So I always had this dual combination in the house. And I had always been interested in Iraq growing up, and when the first Gulf War happened, I was a student, and I was shocked and upset about what occurred. But it wasn't until the recent invasion in 2003 that I realized that I probably wasn't ever going to get to Baghdad and visit our family home and visit my remaining relatives, as I'd always dreamed, and that I would probably have to find out the stories and find out the history of the family by some other means. And so it was at that point where this sort of feeling that everything was about to be gone, mm-hmm. that I had to rush and grab it.
Your debut as an author has been described by Noam Chomsky as a moving memoir, vividly evoking real people in their lives and homes. Lets us understand why Iraqis feel that Americans destroyed their country. How does your book achieve this understanding, if I'm assuming you agree with Mr. Chomsky's review?
Yes. I think my aim from the beginning was to tell personal stories, to tell human stories, to get us away from these sort of geopolitical machinations and this characterization of Iraqis as, you know, Saddam Hussein, this evil dictator. We had no other image of Iraqis. So my idea was to tell my story, and hopefully that would be a microcosm of all the other Iraqis that were going through, had been through these different wars and sanctions and everything. And yes, the story that does emerge is that what happened after the invasion was so horrific and created such anarchy and chaos for the people that they do, you hear people remembering the good old days of Saddam Hussein, which is unbelievable because, of course, everyone was completely repressed and their lives were very, very difficult under his regime. And no one would have said that at the time. But what has happened since has been so catastrophic for ordinary people that they do blame the invasion for that.
Can you tell us a bit about how you put this memoir together? Because it could surprise the listeners that despite being someone who I understand has travelled the Middle East extensively, you've never actually set foot in Iraq.
Yeah. How do you write about a place you've never been physically? And this was something I struggled with at the beginning. But as I realized that even though it's a memoir, it's not really my story directly. It's me telling the stories of all these people that don't have a voice. You know, my cousin in Baghdad who was, you know, a father of two teenagers who was living through this war and the occupation. It's my friend Farhanosh, a photojournalist who went as, is also Iraqi Canadian, and she went as a journalist, and I followed her stories, and my great aunt who was living in our house there. And so I used, you know, my imagination, which most writers use, and these factual stories to pull it together. And it was a great comfort to me when I finally published the book and Iraqis started reading it, because I was most scared of them, because I thought Westerners will be interested in these stories anyway because they're different, but what will Iraqis think of this? And they really loved it. They really took to it. I think they were shocked that I was able to evoke a place and time that I'd never seen. And I think, you know, we often think a reporter can, you know, kind of go into a country and start talking to people and get more of a of an idea because they're there physically and they kind of are there, they've got the setting. But I think because I knew the people and I knew the culture and I knew the background and I knew the history, that actually gave me more insight probably. And the Iraqis were able to talk to me in a way they might be afraid to open up to
may
a journalist.
Play to your advantage.
Yeah. So
talking about that invasion, can you tell us about the experience of your family in the Iraqi capital that morning in March when that the US-led invasion began?
Yeah. Well, what happened was just prior to that, a few days before that, I had phoned my great aunt, and she was one of the last. My grandparents were already dead, and so she was looking after our house in Baghdad. She had her own house, but she had decided to go and stay in our house to stop any looters that would come after the war. So she'd been through a few wars by now. She knew what the what the situation might be. So we all said, you know, don't stay there. Please, you know, just go and be with other people. You know, this is a woman in her 60s alone. And she was adamant that she was going to stay. So she was telling us that she'd stockpiled food, that she'd got one canister of gas, and that she was not knowing how long, you know, the siege would take place, how long the war was going to be. And then she sort of ironically looked out at our orange grove in the back garden, which was all diseased and wasn't bearing fruit anymore. They don't know why, really, but this the sanctions and the war, the previous war. And she looked out and said, you know, I'm going to maybe have to cut these down for firewood, you know, if this canister of gas runs out before things settle. Mm. And so talking to her and her, you know, saying these things, I just felt in complete shock. I'd known this woman when I was younger. She used to come to England and visit us. And I once went to Greece with her and, you know, went in the Mediterranean Sea. And she was this close person in my life. And then I hadn't talked to her for many years because of the politics. And suddenly there she was, and these bombs were going to fall around her and on her house. And she was sort of saying, you know, it's good because our house isn't too far from Saddam. It's quite close to Saddam's palace, you know, but it's you know, further away from these other military targets. So, you know, we might be okay. And you just think,
you know,
it suddenly put me in that position. And suddenly everything that I had read from the other side seemed less relevant or important than this person under these bombs. And then, of course, that would be millions of Baghdadis. And then for the first few nights of the bombing, we were still able to talk to her. And she was terrified, absolutely terrified, and just said, you know, that the amount of the bombs were just unbelievable. Nothing like the Gulf War. It was absolutely, you know, shock and awe, that she was shocked and awed, if you know. And then, of course, the phone lines were bombed. The communications were bombed pretty quickly. So then we had no contact for about, I think it was a few weeks, until our cousin was able to call us. He'd managed to get a mobile phone, and I think people were selling their minutes on anyone who had a phone was letting people use it. So he called us for 1 minute to say that they were all alive. And then we didn't hear from them again for 2 or 3 months until he was able to get on the internet. I think the internet was the first thing that started to work. So,
and what did they do following that? Was it some 6 weeks?
Yeah.
I think Baghdad was pounded.
Yeah.
And what did they do after that? What was life like in Baghdad for those people?
I think after that, there was no normality, and there still isn't, if you can imagine. Like, it just never came back. You know, they tried to go back to school, but, you know, you'd go back to school, but bombs would be going off on your way to school, on your way home. You never knew, you know, when you were going to see people again. So, you know, after a while, people would stop going and they'd keep their kids at home. For him, he tried to go into work, but he didn't have a job anymore. The business he was in like water treatment. He couldn't get any contracts. He couldn't get any work with people. So slowly you realize that in a space of a few weeks, your entire life has changed forever. And, so you have to try and find a new way to survive. And in the end, they left, those people. They don't live there anymore because, you know, there was no future.
Following the shock and awe.
Right.
And then, as you said, it was a struggle to try and grapple back some form of normality.
Yeah.
What the perception was of the United States
right.
after that?
Well, I think there was a hope. I mean, I know within my family, they had learned not to hope for much by this point. But I think that there was sort of a 5% hope among Iraqis that what America was saying it was going to do, that it was going to create stability and democracy in the country, that was what people dreamed of. I mean, they do want that. No one wants to live under a dictator. No one wants that kind of life. But I think very quickly they felt that wasn't going to happen. I mean, you know, my family had a family friend whose entire family was shot at a checkpoint by an American soldier, you know, within the first few weeks of the invasion. There were things like that went on right from the beginning, which caused Iraqis to be afraid of the Americans. And once you had that, it wasn't going to be very possible for the Americans to really hold on to the country. You know, you have to have the people on your side if you want to occupy and stay in a country like that. And I think that they just didn't because of the history. There was the Gulf War, and then the sanctions regime was so horrific and had caused so much pain for ordinary people that they didn't trust it anymore. And they thought, well, why would America invade? And, you know, they didn't believe it was for them. So there was always this other idea that there was some other reason for it. And they knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. They knew that couldn't possibly be.
How was that? How were they so certain of that?
Just because the level the country had descended to, first of all, I mean, from what it had been in the 80s, to have a nuclear program, you have to have, you know, high-powered scientists. And, you know, it's a very complex thing. You know, it's not something you can kind of do in your basement, right? Mm. Plus, so much of it had been dismantled in the Gulf War right after. And there had been so many inspections. And even the inspectors that were going in at that time were saying, like, we haven't found anything. We need more time to check, but really, there's nothing there. So I think Iraqis were pretty convinced of that already. So there was just very little trust that the motives were good. But I think there was hope. There was hope that maybe they were wrong, that maybe America was going to save them and make things better.
So what then are the most, do you think, speaking to members of your family and the wider Iraqi community, what are the most commonly held misconceptions by Westerners of Iraqis?
Well, I think that they just don't know them at all. Like, they just have no picture of them. What they picture are, you know, militants and people with guns and people, sort of crazy people. And they don't have anything else to really compare it to unless they've happened to meet Iraqis, you know, in the West or whatever. And then they often have a very different view. But I think they think women are oppressed. They think women are treated as they are in the Gulf countries or Saudi. And they weren't. You know, I have three aunts. They all, you know, grew up in the 50s and 60s and went to university. One's a doctor, one's a chemist, one's a worked in, you know, customs and so they were not, they were educated. They
professionals.
They were professionals. Yeah. And they were, you know, I'm from a Christian background, but they were friends with all these other Muslim women who also had the same kind of background. So it was a highly educated, secular society, much like our own. You know, you would relate to people that you would meet from Baghdad. But people just don't have those images of, you know, women wearing makeup and doing their hair and, you know, wearing Western clothing. And so I think, yeah, just anything I could tell you about a life in Baghdad would be a surprise, even that they used to be able to come, that you could drive from Baghdad to London over through Europe. People, you know, it feels like now Iraq's on another planet, or it's just so impenetrable. It's just so impossible to get there. And that's the thing that saddens me the most, because I think as soon as you have that bond broken, it's very easy for people to believe any kind of propaganda about people, and very easy to go to war, because it's totally abstract.
And of course, Iraq is now thrust once again into the headlines.
Yes.
Negatively so, because of this ISIS insurgency.
Right.
And I'm curious, we can all read the news.
Yeah.
And listen to those reports.
Yeah.
But what has been your family's reaction to this this jihadist spread?
Well, it's a very complex situation. I mean, first of all, I just want to say that, you know, because I'm from a Christian family, that the Christians have been there, you know, for 2,000 years. It's a very ancient Christian community that we're talking about up around Mosul. You know, the liturgy that they use is in Aramaic, which is the language of Christ. So there are monasteries, churches, all kinds of ancient places in that area that have manuscripts and, you know, incredible buildings and tombs. And, you know, it's a very rich cultural area. So for us to be at a moment in time where in Mosul there is not a Christian left because of this threat is a tragedy for all of Christianity and for civilization, you know. And we've seen this from before the war. There were about 5% of the population were Christians, and they have been the biggest population who've been refugees. So most of them have left. A huge portion had already been leaving, because already right from the beginning there were terrorist attacks that were persecuting them, which had never happened under Saddam Hussein. There was no jihadist threat coming out of Iraq before 2003. So this is terrifying for everyone. And I talk about Christians because that's my family, but they're also targeting Shia and, you know, creating these sectarian divides. So it's a very, it's absolutely tragic. And, you know, the specifics that, you know, you're getting, that they're burning these manuscripts that are left, that they're stealing, you know, people's gold in Mosul families. You know, well, many of the women, they collect their gold, and that's sort of what they have. Right. So they've been told to leave Mosul unless they convert, and then they're robbed as they leave. Their property's taken away. Once that happens, people aren't going to go back. So they're going to be refugees, or, you know, and I'm talking about people like you and me, just normal people, often professionals, often, you know, highly educated. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I mean, I look at it as the country is now already over. To me, Iraq is actually finished at this point. You have Baghdad being separated from Kurdistan and the central area. The Iraqi army obviously has no power beyond, I don't know where it has power. The government obviously has no power. You have this jihadist group of a few thousand people that have managed to get in and create something. What they'll create, how long it will last, who knows? But to me, once something is broken like that, how are they going to put it back together again? I really don't know.
And do you see yourself at any time in the near future taking that journey and going to Iraq?
No, I mean, I had, just before this had happened, I had been dreaming, okay, I don't think I'm brave enough to go to Baghdad still. And now our house is no longer there. We had to sell it, and there's no family left. But maybe I'll go to northern Iraq. Maybe I'll go to Erbil. There's actually a literary festival that was started there, and I thought maybe I'd go somehow to that. And that's a very beautiful region that I would love to visit. And Mosul was one of the places, and I thought I would love to go and see some of this, these ancient places.
But now you'll be walking onto a front line of civil war.
I mean, you couldn't go. I mean, you couldn't go now. You could go to Kurdistan probably still, but it's extremely tense, right? I mean, what are the, you know, these people are not going to give up on, they want to take the whole territory. Yeah, it's strange.
So you don't know the fate then of the subject of the title, the orange trees of Baghdad. You don't know what happened.
No. And it's funny because as I was writing the book, the whole time I was writing and subsequently, I never knew how the story was going to end. It was a strange thing to be writing a book without knowing what the end was going to be. And I kind of just had to stop at some point because the story kept going. But when I was talking to my aunts yesterday, I was saying, could you believe that it would actually get worse? Like at every point, you're like, it cannot get worse for the Iraqis. You know, you have people who were, let's say, living in Basra. There's a family that then was had to move to Baghdad because it was unsafe in Basra. Then she had to leave Baghdad to go to Mosul. And now she was in Mosul. And now she's going to have to leave to go to another camp. And you have like, levels of trauma there that are unbelievable. And yeah, so it just becomes like, what's next? I mean, you know, can you believe that they've set up an Islamic caliphate in the like a medieval style society right in the middle of the Middle East? I mean,
exactly.
It's the stuff of fiction.
So if you walk into a bookshop,
yeah,
and you go to a particular section and your book is there,
yeah,
it is surrounded by other options. Yes. I mean, why do we reach for your debut?
Right.
Over the others available.
Oh, because it's got Noam Chomsky and Naomi Klein on the front. Two good reasons.
Two great
at least
reasons.
You know, that's not me saying it, it's them. No. But more, I just hope that you want to connect with people. You want to find out what Iraqis are really like, what they're thinking, what was the invasion like for them? What was the aftermath like? What were the sanctions like? I go back and I tell the history of Iraq through the family from when the British were there up until this recent, probably goes till about 2007. And then I have an epilogue that kind of brings you up to date. So just a lot of people have said that they didn't really understand what was going on until they read the book. So that the narrative that they were getting from the news was so broken up and so kind of complicated, they just couldn't figure it out. But by reading the book, they got a whole sense of sort of longevity, of a narrative, of something that actually did make sense when you start to put the pieces together. And that's what I hope people will get, that it isn't as complicated as you think, and that if you start to put energy into trying to understand.
Leila Nadir, award-winning novelist, about her memoir, The Orange Trees of Baghdad. And that's our special Labour Day edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can email us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can always follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. Tuesday, we return to our coverage of all the breaking news and global events from our bureaus worldwide. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington. For everyone, with Feature Story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.